We're listening to what I found probably the most evocative portion of Bruckner's Symphony Number 4, because it sounds like fox hunting. And I was just telling Gregory Voida, I'm probably one of the few classical music hosts around who has actually been fox hunting. And this, it's so true. It's so true. Well, our journey continues on Friday as the HSO Classical Series takes us to Austria, where we'll encounter our old friend Beethoven and maybe not so well-known Anton Bruckner. So it's good to see you again.
Good to be here.
When you were here for the Halloween show, I asked you which concert was scarier, the Halloween one or this one. Have you decided?
Yeah, this is definitely scarier. Probably by the looks, the Halloween one was it's supposed to be scary, and it was scary in a very funny way. It was a lot of fun. But Bruckner is definitely, you know, I'm not sure I should look this up if they named a mountain after Bruckner. If they haven't, yeah, they should. Mm-hmm. There should be a high peak named after Bruckner, because this is definitely a mountain for, you know, conductors to climb, and to get up there is no easy task. And it is definitely, if not scary, but it's definitely challenging.
Right. Anton Bruckner does not get a lot of airplay. For one thing, it's the pieces are really long. Like this symphony is over an hour long.
They don't fit your schedule, right? The radio schedule.
And I also found it challenging as a listener. Of course, my car stereo is not that good, but I had trouble with the dynamics. Does that pose a problem for you as a conductor?
Not really. Actually, this week I'm trying a different seating arrangement for the orchestra. We have tried this last season for the last classical concert, and what we're doing, we rearranged our risers a little bit and put the basses up on risers towards the back of the stage on my right side, mm-hmm. from a conductor's point of view, which gives just more, you know, sound to the bass section, because you're up on a riser, so it projects better. And when you have the basses in the back, it kind of like pushes everything forward, you know. Uh-huh. It's like a back wheel drive,
right,
which drives everybody uh-huh. everybody forward, because if you're hearing the lowest part of the piece coming from behind you, or if you are a brass player, you're hearing it right next to you, that always pushes the tempo forward. So it always makes it just like more lively. And uh-huh. we're actually enjoying it with the orchestra this week. It's a nice experiment again for us.
That's good to know, because I was wondering if the musicians felt particularly challenged by it as well.
Challenged by the piece or challenged by the... Yes, of course. I mean, this is very demanding, you know. I was joking in one of the rehearsals that I think, you know, Bruckner just woke up every morning and said, it's morning, give me more French horns. And you know, whenever a new theme starts, it is always in the French horn. Uh-huh. It's a lot of playing. It's, you know, welcome to the universe of the brass players. And of course, they're enjoying it tremendously, but it is demanding.
And Anton Bruckner was sort of an interesting character. I did enjoy reading about him. He had evidently OCD. Somebody caught him standing outside of a building, staring at a tree, he was trying to count the leaves. So he was very obsessive. Have you noticed that in the score?
Well, I think we're just giving the best, you know, preview to this concert. It's like, come to the Huntsville Symphony. We are playing a long piece by a crazy person. You must be there at the VBC. You know, it's very interesting. The real challenge for me in this composition is how to get into it. Is a little bit similar than the music of Messiaen or Arvo Pärt or Philip Glass. You know, when somehow the notes, like, if I want to use big words, you know, every note, every measure of Bruckner is like a cathedral. You know, mm-hmm. you're just entering a different cathedral with every measure or with every movement, and it's big space, and you know. He was an organ player, and I imagine him going into the church, not during a service, but before, like early morning, when, you know, they let organ players practice before the early morning service starts. And he would be alone in this huge cathedral, alone with God and with an organ, an amazing instrument that you have power over. And it's just you and this amazing building, and every note counts and every note stands on its own. So there is like this power that I need to, you know, I need to find it for myself in every note and in every phrase with Bruckner.
Yeah, his music has been described as a cathedral of sound. And I've read the same thing. He spent a lot of time in a monastery, and for most of his life, he spent a lot of time in the monastery. That's where he went back to. Yeah, you can't avoid the architecture in it. He also does a really great job with his hunting scene. Let's listen to a little bit more as galloping across the countryside with Anton Bruckner. Anton Bruckner creates a cathedral of sound, but he also does a good job with the outdoorsy aspect of it as well, I think.
And it's typically the music that draws you in. You know, once you you're there and you listen to it, you are becoming the part of this universe that was created by Anton Bruckner. And you know, Bruckner was a great was an admirer, a great fan of Wagner.
Mm-hmm. He worshipped him,
and he was kind of writing that kind of symphonic music that you can hear in a Wagner opera, except there are no singers and there's no story. This is real and true symphonic music, and it goes really well, I think, with the tradition of this orchestra, you know, with all the German roots, and I think we ought to cultivate Bruckner here, not only because it's the tradition, and not only because you know, I'm coming from that culture as well, but also because it's just great music. It's very powerful, and you know, to hear it live, I think is something that you really want to do.
Yeah, again, it didn't sound that great on my car's crummy sound system, but that's what I'm thinking, and you need to experience. And again, to see it, there's going to be a visual aspect as well. I want to see how a bass gets his instrument up on a riser.
Yeah, and I look good too. You know? it's all part of the experience. Yeah, please come to the concert hall.
We'll listen to a little bit. Did you say the second movement?
Yeah.
Of the Bruckner.
Thank you.
Anton Bruckner's Symphony No. 4, the Romantic Symphony, will be part of the Huntsville Symphony Orchestra's concert coming up this evening at 7:30 at the Mark C. Smith Concert Hall. I was reading an article in The Guardian UK, and it said that that Bruckner was a credulous yokel who propositioned girls half his age, a death-obsessed ghoul who kept a photo of his mother's corpse, a cranky, backwards-looking obsessive, the composer of some of the 19th century's greatest, grandest, and most ambitious symphonies. Anton Bruckner was all of these things. One thing he wasn't, however, was a writer of beautiful music offering serene escapism.
I'm wondering if he was drinking his coffee from a plain red cup, or what's the deal there? You know, it's always interesting to me to, you know, to read these things about composers and how they were and what they did and what they wore and how they drank their coffee. Ultimately, I think yes, there are a lot of connections, of course, between, you know, creator and music, but ultimately these pieces stand for themselves. They're really, if you've ever written anything, even a little song with your guitar, or if you played anything with a garage band or played the piano, and not just by, you know, reading music, but also composing something, you know that compositions kind of write themselves. You know, they have their own rules, and you have to follow the rules. It's not like you can write whatever you want. And especially with a deeply religious composer like Bruckner. I think it's the same thing as it was with Johann Sebastian Bach. He just said, you know, I'm just writing it down. Every note is coming from up there. Mm. So I'm just relaying what I hear, what I'm supposed to write. And I think that power, the powerful characters of this music and all the things that take you away, you know, just kind of take you out of the everyday life and put you in a completely different universe. It's mostly coming from this notion.
And Beethoven, for his time, was quite a radical. I mean, we think, oh, you know, Mr. Symphony No. 5, Mr. Four Elise, but he did sort of break the rules a little bit, especially in this Piano Concerto No. 4, because it was a new thing. Imagine the people who heard it for the first time. First of all, they were cold. It was in that famous old Beethoven concert that went on for like 6 hours. But he actually had the audacity to begin the Piano Concerto with the soloist.
And on Sunday, we are playing our first casual classics with also Kirill Gerstein, mm-hmm. our pianist, who is playing this piano concerto. And I'm playing the clarinet. We're only playing one piece together with Kirill, and that is the Quintet for Winds and Piano by Beethoven. Every movement starts with the piano. I'm like, why do we need a clarinet in this? You know, he himself, Beethoven, was a pianist, of course. It has a lot to do with that. And yes, he was great at you know, using the traditional forms of his era. You know, he learned a lot from, of course, from Mozart and Haydn, but also reinventing them every time he wrote something. So this piano concerto is definitely revolutionary as far as a form goes, and the way he goes from one key to the next, and orchestration wise, and those little cadenzas in the piano. It's really a fascinating piece.
this is actually Emmanuel Axe playing here. He's a pretty good pianist, too.
Oh, yeah.
he's been to Huntsville, but we'll be welcoming Kirill Gerstein, who is... He's sort of from all over, basically. He was born in Russia, but you said his parents live in Boston. He went to Berklee College of Music, which is where Microwave Dave Gallagher went to school.
All righty. Yes. Now I know that, too. Yeah, and Kirill now is living in Berlin, Germany, with his wife and kid. And I have had the pleasure to perform many different things with him. And we also have one teacher in common. He's still... going to Budapest, Hungary to play for Mr. Radosh, who is he's a legendary chamber music and piano teacher, and I studied chamber music with him. So we also have some, you know, common ground there when it gets to playing a chamber music piece like we're doing it on Sunday or performing with an orchestra.
So tell me about the relationship between the pianist and the conductor. It helps that you two know each other, or does it? How does that affect the rehearsal process and eventually the performance?
It definitely makes it easier. I can guess things better, and he can guess things better. It's all chamber music when it comes to a concerto versus just a symphony. I mean, you have to, you know, listen and then to respond to what you hear. As we said it earlier, this was the last movement of the Beethoven Piano Concerto Number 4, what we just heard. And you hear that the piano starts with the theme, so there's immediately a tempo, there's immediately a character. You immediately hear, as a conductor or an orchestra musician, how certain things like little grace notes are being interpreted by the pianist, and your job is to match that. And when you start something and then the piano responds, it goes back and forth. So it's pretty fascinating. It's like a jam session, except the music is written down.
It is.
Kirill just made some news, actually, because last time I read about him was in New York Times, and he just recorded Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto Number 1, which is a warhorse, and
everybody
playing it,
knows.
Right?
Oh, yeah, I saw he had recorded that. I'm thinking, why go back there and do that again?
Because he was using the manuscript that was used by the composer himself when the piece was premiered, and it changes the entire piece completely. I mean, it's different tempo, different characters. It's fascinating how there is a tradition of performance of a piece, and many of us conductors and performers struggle with that from time to time, because there is such a strong tradition of, you know, how this has been done in the last 100 years. These are the tempi. This is where you add a little extra rest. This is where you're holding the note longer. This is the tempo you're supposed to play it. And when somebody actually looks at the score and says, oh, okay, well, that's great, but what about the metronome markings of Beethoven? I mean, okay, maybe his metronome was broken, but he knew what he was doing. So why don't we just go back to this source and try to figure out what he really wanted to hear? And this is what Kirill did with Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto Number 1. And the reception is just overwhelming. I mean, everybody's loving it. And he's now being talked about all over in this business and around the world. I always knew that he was a great and amazing pianist, but I'm really happy for him for this piece of success. And also, I'm looking forward to hearing this Tchaikovsky recording, because I want to learn more about Tchaikovsky and the work that somebody like Kirill does when they, you know, dig up stuff about the composition is helping me and helping other performers, conductors or pianists if they go and try to play, let's say, Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto Number 1.
One of the things I'm curious about in his bio, it says his early training and experience in jazz has contributed an important element to his interpretive style.
I think when you play jazz, I tried it a couple of times, it's a completely different experience, and it does add to your playing when you're playing classical music. And the main reason for that is because in jazz, it's even more true what I was saying about chamber music, is that you have to react.
Mm-hmm.
You don't only react to what others are playing, but you're also reacting to yourself, you know. I love hearing jazz players when they make a mistake. I mean, you know, for my polished ears, it's pretty clear that, oh, they just made a mistake. Mm-hmm. But then they create a texture right after that the mistake is somehow becomes the part of the piece. And that's fascinating to me, because you play a different chord and you go to a completely different direction. Same thing as what we were saying about composing, you know, that you play one pitch differently and then it takes you to a completely different direction. You have to go that path. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have a choice, but you actually have to follow the rules of the piece, and the piece somehow writes itself. So playing jazz gives you this ability, you know, to translate that to Beethoven's music, and how you can be flexible yet still playing what he wrote on the paper. And also, it's a completely different way of listening and reacting to your partners in chamber music.
I read that he taught himself to play jazz by listening to his parents' record collection. And then there was a jazz musician who was playing a music festival at the Soviet Union, heard him play, and he was invited when he was 14 to study jazz piano. He was the youngest student ever to attend Boston's Berklee College of Music. It's kind of a big deal.
And I'm really happy that Kirill is here this week. You don't want to miss him. I mean, he's really a rising star, and I think more than a rising star now. I mean, he's a really great name pianist, and it's an honor and for me to be able to perform with him, especially the Beethoven Piano Concerto number 4, and also just to pick up my clarinet and play some chamber music.
Do you practice on the plane?
No, I don't practice on the plane. I actually practice in the back of the AGSO office at the Von Braun Center. And you should ask my colleagues if they like it or not, but that's where I practice.
Well, we have the classical concert, which is this evening at 7:30 at the Mark C. Smith Concert Hall. But then we have the smaller casual classics, which is the next day. Not the next day. It's on Sunday, November the 15th at 3:30. And that's at Roberts Recital Hall, a little bit more intimate setting there here at UAH. And I know you're going to be playing, but it says, I looked at the program, there really isn't one aside from the Beethoven Quintet.
That's the main piece of our first casual classics of this season. And we called it Beethoven Conversations, because we're going to talk about Beethoven. And we're going to talk about this particular composition, as well as the piano concerto. I wanted our audience to learn more about Kirill as a performer. As usually, the casual classics is about, you know, seeing what's behind the scenes, mm-hmm. And how someone like Kirill thinks about what he is doing, and how a performer can change or add to what's on the paper. You know, you write music down and it can be in a drawer for 200 years, and it only, you know, becomes music really when somebody plays it, right? So this is a living tradition, and Kirill Gerstein himself is an important link that links us to Beethoven and links us to Tchaikovsky. He's going to be playing a solo piano composition by Franz Liszt as well, that apparently somehow is connected to Beethoven. Kirill and I had a little conversation about this. I told him what I want to ask him about during the casual classics. But we're just going to have a conversation like him and myself would have over a coffee, except that the audience can listen in and hear what we're saying and just get an idea of how you put something like this Beethoven piece on stage and what comes before you actually play even the first note, and how you approach it and how you practice it. I like to believe, you know, that Beethoven is alive. You know, there is this funny show that Beethoven lives upstairs. Beethoven lives upstairs. He lives upstairs just above my apartment, and he lives upstairs of Kirill Gerstein's apartment. Mm-hmm. And if we have a question, we can just go upstairs and knock on the door. Of course, he's deaf, so he won't hear it. But my point is that we are having a conversation with these composers on a daily basis. And that conversation goes through the written music and go through the tradition that trickled down to us directly from them, through our teachers and through great performers of years and years and hundreds of years. And it's something that we are keeping alive. And it's amazing how this art form is now several hundred years old, and it's still alive and it's still well, and there's a lot of life in it, right?
And it's still entertaining.
It is still entertaining, indeed.
and always something to learn. And you'll have this great opportunity to get up close with this world-class pianist Sunday afternoon at 3:30 at Roberts Recital Hall. More information is available at hso.org, or you can always call 256-539-4818. Now, that's this weekend. I know the next concert is New Year's Eve.
Next concert is New Year's Eve. The HSO is not performing, but we have a wonderful group and a wonderful program for all of you who like our little tradition here, which is to go to a concert before you go out partying. So I encourage you to...
People do that?
I know.
That's a thing. I usually just go to the concert and go home.
Well, and other people just go out partying without the concert. But I think it's a good way to start your New Year's Eve celebration. And it's great music. It's lighthearted. It's it just puts you in the mood and we would like to see you there. Come and join us on New Year's Eve. And then, you know, the season just goes on in January.
Yeah, with the abduction from the Seraglio.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. We're continuing our little thing with doing operas in a concert version. And I really wanted to do a Mozart opera for a long time now. And I think that Abduction from the Seraglio is just perfect for, you know, a concert version, and Ron Roberts is going to be
narrating it. He is one of the funniest people I know.
Yes. And what we're going to do is usually this is done, you know, the conversations between the singers go in English, and then when they sing, they do it in German. But I just cut all the conversations and gave everything to Ron. And so he's going to be the Pasha and the narrator at the same time. So I asked him to, you know, put his spin on the story and tell the story, but also make it Ron Roberts and make it Hans.
Are you sure about this?
I am absolutely sure.
Ron Roberts is one of those people. I can't even look at him without getting tickled. So he's a genuinely funny guy. So yes, always something new and different and exciting with the Huntsville Symphony Orchestra. Anything you want to add before you face down Beethoven and Bruckner?
Come and support me, please.
and listen, give Bruckner a chance.
Absolutely. Well, we're talking about Bruckner like he's a scary guy here, but this is really, really strong and amazing music. If you like Wagner and if you like Brahms, if you like late Beethoven, then you will love this piece. It's great orchestration. It really shows what a full symphony orchestra can do live in a concert hall. And with this new seating that we have now, I'm very excited about that. I think we get even more and better sound out of the HSO and out of the concert hall. So please come and join us listening to Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 4 and Bruckner Symphony No. 4.